This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has backed off a threat made earlier by Moscow of retaliation for the downing of a Russian aircraft over Syrian territory that the Kremlin said was indirectly caused by Israeli warplanes. Mr. Putin said it looks more like a chain of tragic accidental circumstances, but Israeli planes did not take down the Russian aircraft with a loss of 15 on board. Russia's defense ministry said Syrian anti-aircraft batteries downed the plane, and it holds Israel responsible for only giving Russia a minute's warning and exposing the plane to crossfire. Mr. Putin spoke about the incident with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, telling him agreements to avoid such dangerous incidents were not observed. Meanwhile, Special UN Envoy to Syria, Stefan de Mistura, welcomed the agreement between Russia and Turkey to establish a demilitarized zone to allow radical elements to leave Idlib province with its 3 million civilians and avoid an assault on the last major rebel stronghold.
We are pleased that there is de-escalation in one major area, Idlib. And now that we have this deal, there is no reason not to move forward expeditiously with the political process.
Damascus also welcomed the agreement, but vowed to pursue efforts to recover every inch of Syrian territory. As Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa delivered his first State of the Union address, opposition members of parliament walked out over the disputed July election. Among them, Movement for Democratic Change National Chairperson Tabitha Kumalo.
We are saying it, Mnangagwa is illegitimate, and we want him to prove to us how many votes he garnered. And there is the issue of us dealing with the issue of the stolen elections, which they have to be rectified.
Mr. Mnangagwa told lawmakers the election is now passed and it's time to focus on delivering promises made to the electorate. This is VOA News. There was renewed violence Tuesday between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli troops killed two Palestinians in clashes along the Gaza border. The clashes occurred late in the day at the Eretz crossing point as Israel observed the Yom Kippur holiday. Dozens were injured as youths threw stones at troops and set fires. In Jerusalem, a Palestinian man was shot and killed when he tried to stab a Jewish worshiper near the Damascus Gate. At the inter-Korean summit in Pyongyang, South Korea's President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are expected to issue a joint statement Wednesday, the second day of their three-day meeting, that might give an idea how they will deepen bilateral ties and rekindle stalled nuclear talks. Heather Nauert is a U.S. spokesperson.
We hope to see a meaningful, verifiable steps toward the denuclearization of North Korea. It is the third inter-Korean summit between President Moon and also Chairman Kim. It represents, in our view, a historic opportunity for Chairman Kim to follow through on the commitments that he made to President Trump at the Singapore summit, but also the commitments that he made in Panmunjom.
The North Korean leader at that meeting in April pledged to work toward the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is to host a meeting of the U.N. Security Council on North Korea September 27th. The International Criminal Court's prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, Tuesday opened a preliminary investigation into alleged crimes targeting the Rohingya Muslim community in Myanmar, also known as Burma.
The judges of the pretrial chamber 1 have confirmed that this court may indeed exercise jurisdiction over the alleged deportation of the Rohingya people from Myanmar to Bangladesh, as well as, potentially, other crimes under the Rome Statute.
At the same time, a UN fact-finding mission on Myanmar issued a 440-page report denouncing what it called the extreme brutality of Myanmar's security forces. Britain and Finland have frozen funding to Zambia, suspecting it of misusing the funds. President Edward Lungu said late Tuesday in a statement he wants a speedy and decisive investigation into the matter. U.S.-Canadian negotiators meet Wednesday for another round of trade talks aimed at forging a replacement to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, said there will be no negotiation in public.
I think that that agreement has served us well. It has helped to create a real atmosphere of trust and good faith at the negotiating table.
The U.S., which reached a separate NAFTA deal with partner Mexico last month, has imposed a deadline of October 1st. Wall Street rallied Tuesday despite trade tensions with China, the benchmark Dow Jones adding 185 points to 26,246. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf reacts to claims her government might have printed millions of dollars unknown to the George Weah government.
She told me strongly that she was very disappointed in the manner in which the Weah-led government was trying to implicate her administration into this missing Katrina saga.
Rodney Sear is publisher of the Front Page Africa newspaper. Eswatini police allegedly attacked protesters. Ugandan women allegedly assaulted in post-election violence detailed their ordeals. And Zambia's government responds to Britain's suspension of aid.
The money that has not been accounted for is $4.1 million. So the Telegraph story grossly misrepresents the situation when they say hundreds of millions of British pounds.
Emma Standard, spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu, and the UN General Assembly will host high-level talks to combat tuberculosis. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says she's disappointed by claims that her government printed about 16 billion Liberian dollars, or about 104 million U.S. dollars, and brought it into the country unknown to President George Weah's government. The former president told Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper that Information Minister Eugene Nnamdi and Justice Minister Frank Musa Dane are trying to impugn her legacy and her government. In another development about the missing millions of dollars, the Weah government has told the so-called 15 persons of interest not to leave the country. Front Page Africa editor Rodney Sear, who interviewed former President Sirleaf, says new documents show the money might have been brought into the country during the Weah government.
She told me strongly that she was very disappointed in the manner in which the Weah-led government was trying to implicate her administration into this missing container saga. She was clear that she was not happy and that they were deliberately trying to impugn her legacy and her administration. I think she was not happy in the sense that the two ministers, Minister Eugene Nnamdi, who was the Information Minister, and Minister Frank Musa Dane, who is the Minister of Justice, have in the past 48 hours suggested that the containers were signed for in November 2017. And Sirleaf was still on the last leg of a presidency. They have now routine documents that suggest otherwise, that the Katrina actually left the port on February 2nd, 2018, and another one on March 31st, 2018. So those two containers left the port during the administration of George Weah.
I read your story, Rodney, where former President Sirleaf is suggesting that perhaps the Central Bank of Liberia undertook an internal investigation and issue a directive which she thinks might have refuted these allegations. But she claims here that the Justice Ministry refused to approve the release of this report.
Yeah, which is very strange because she believes that the report that the Central Bank submitted to the government of President Weah vindicates her administration. And she doesn't know why they would not make that information public. Because before the interview happened, she told me that she was awaiting a report from the Central Bank before she can go on the record. And I think that report came in, and when she saw it, she was told by the Central Bank staffers that they were told not to put that out. That, in a sense, suggests to me that she feels that something sinister is in the works against her legacy.
The question I think I would love to ask to Minister Nnamdi is that, according to the timeline established by the Weah government, what the minister told me on Monday is that the monies began coming in November 2017 to August 2018. In November 2017, Nnamdi was the Minister of Information. Can he say that he did not know?
Well, that's the contradiction in this controversy, James, because everyone in Liberia knows that Minister Nnamdi was the mouthpiece of the Sirleaf administration. And for him to now suggest that the new government, which he now serves in the same capacity, was not aware of anything that happened in the last administration, when he should have been the one pushing that agenda, it makes everybody feel that, you know, he may have something, you know, sinister up his sleeves, because it doesn't make sense for him to now be, you know, championing the cause of the new administration, at least the old administration, when he's the tie that binds both of them.
Rodney, in the meantime, the Information Ministry on Tuesday put out a press release in which it advised of 15 so-called persons of interest not to leave the country because the investigative team wants their cooperation in the ongoing investigation. Who are some of the key people that the government is referring to?
Well, four of those names are employees of Central Bank. They were at the port to pick the money from the container and take it to Central Bank. So I think the government wants to make sure that nobody leaves the country. And that's why they put this list up.
Rodney, a very interesting story. We'll continue to follow this story. And thank you very much again for the update.
Thank you so much, sir.
Rodney Sears, editor-in-chief of Liberia's front page, Africa newspaper. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The Zambian government says it is aware of possible misappropriation of development assistance to Zambia by six Western donor countries, including the United Kingdom. Amos Chanda, spokesman for President Edgard Lungu, says the amount involved is $4.1 million, and a Zambian government audit shows that the money might have been misappropriated by low-ranking government officials. The revelation came after the Daily Telegraph reported Tuesday that Britain had frozen its entire development funding to Zambia because government officials stole millions of pounds and bought expensive cars. Chanda says the Telegraph story misrepresented the amount of money allegedly misappropriated.
The amount involved for the money that has not been accounted for is $4.1 million. So the Telegraph story grossly misrepresents the situation when they say hundreds of millions of British pounds. That is totally incorrect. That is not to say a misapplication of $4.1 million is acceptable. In any case, what has revealed this $4.1 million unaccounted for funds is a government audit. The president ordered an administrative inquiry into this 4 months ago. But because you could not announce an ongoing investigation for purposes of not alerting potential suspects, it does appear like this revelation by the British government is what has caught the Zambian government's attention to that. That is incorrect.
But the article also says that the British Department for International Development has also demanded a forensic audit of Zambian government spending after evidence emerged suggesting it had been embezzled on a significant scale since 2012.
That is totally incorrect. The forensic audit was ordered by the president when information began to emerge that there could be possible abuse. And this is February this year. This government came into office in 2011, end of the year, September, October 2011. So if a forensic audit was ordered in 2012, it may have been ordered before this PF administration came into office. Preliminary information given to the president under a Zambian government-led investigation revealed that money meant for the poor in social cash transfer could have been used to buy motor vehicles for operations for the postal services which administers the social cash transfer. That money could have been used to pay retirees.
I know your president was part of the China-Africa summit that took place just last month. There's a letter a friend of mine sent me. It's written to the U.S. Department of Treasury. The opening sentence there, we write to express our concern over bailout requests to the International Monetary Fund by countries who have accepted predatory Chinese infrastructure finances. Are you aware of this letter? Because it suggests that this so-called China debt trap diplomacy is Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, to be a threat to U.S. national interest or security.
Yes, we are aware. The position of Zambia since time immemorial, the founders of this nation quite correctly arrived at the position that Zambia shall be a non-aligned country. His Excellency President Lungu maintains that position, that Zambia will remain a non-aligned country. Our international diplomacy is not premised on creating enemies with one country in order to please another. We try to be strategic and arrive at friendships on the basis of bilateral arrangements.
Amos Chanda is spokesman for Zambian President Edgard Lungu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Today is Wednesday, September 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa On The Voice of America, I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The yet-to-be-registered Swaziland United Democratic Front, the SUDF political party, has condemned Monday's alleged police attack on protesters in Mazini. Six injured protesters are reportedly being treated at the rally Fit King Memorial Hospital. The workers, organized by the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, were protesting for better working conditions. The organizers denied local media reports that the police were not informed about the demonstration. Meanwhile, the SUDF has called on the international community to impose sanctions on selected government officials in response to the alleged attacks on the workers. Brian Sangwani is the Secretary General of the Swazi United Democratic Front.
We actually condemn the act of brutalities against workers in Swaziland. And today's acts were not the first one, as we have actually stated in our statement that it started in June 30, and also where workers were brutalized and butchered by the police in their march in Mbabane. And we've seen it last month where teachers were gathered for a night vigil in their headquarters, and also the police pounced on them and brutalized them and shot them with live rounds of ammunition. And in the process, we had several of them being injured, but luckily we never actually recorded any dead. And even today, it became the same case whereby a protest action that is actually protected under the Industrial Relations Act of the country, we have seen workers being brutalized, seriously so by the police for no apparent reason.
Supporters of the government are saying that these demonstrators failed to alert the police and that they broke the law by disturbing people because the demonstration went through the principal streets of Manzini and other places, and that is disruptive to business activities and all that.
This particular strike was communicated some time ago with the government and also authorities of the town. So they are well aware of this particular action today. But we know that the Swazi police in nature are a rogue organization who actually does not have any fear of meeting brutality against the workers who are protesting. As I'm making this particular example of an attack that happened at the headquarters of the teachers themselves, where it was a property of the teachers, but police were able to pounce on them at that particular issue.
So as a political party, though unregistered in Eswatini, what is your next line of action about what you describe as the brutality meted out to protesters by the Eswatini police?
These particular issues are issues that are actually difficult to actually discuss and actually conclude them within Swaziland. As you know, that Swaziland itself is a police state, and the courts as well are not even independent. So discussing this particular issue within the context of Swaziland and reach an amicable solution with the government is something that is not foreseeable. So we're thinking that the Federation to COSO must take this particular issue to international organizations like the ILO and other human rights organizations that are actually capable of dealing with this particular matter. But looking forward into that, Swaziland is sanctioned for this unprincipled action.
How do you want Eswatini to be sanctioned? By whom?
We want targeted sanction. That will target the government, by the way, not all the people of Swaziland, because we have recently had sanction of AGOA, whereby we have seen that the effects of the sanctions were affected mainly the people who are ordinary people. So the sanctions that we want to be actually meted against the government, they should be by the principal organizations, like the human rights organizations in the region and in the continent and also throughout the world.
Brian Sangwini is the Secretary General of the Swaziland United Democratic Front. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotter from Manzini. 1 month after election-related violence in northern Uganda, two women who said they were brutally assaulted by security officers are still recovering from their injuries. The government has questioned the women's claims while stopping short of an explicit denial. Halima Atumani spoke to the injured women and reports from Kampala.
Jen Abola and Asara Knight say they were beaten by Ugandan security personnel in the Arua municipality on the evening of August 13th. Both women were part of the campaign team for Kassiano Wadri, an opposition candidate in a by-election for a parliament seat. holding a final planning meeting at a hotel, opposition legislators were forced to run and hide at the sound of gunshots fired at them. Abola ran into a bathroom. She says she was pulled out roughly and attacked by security officers on the order of a regional police commander. The officers demanded she tell them the whereabouts of legislator Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine.
Started kicking me, beating me with those sticks over their batons, the gun, pricking with the barrel of the gun, using the butt of the gun. At one point, he jumped on my back, said, "I'm going to kill you if you don't tell me where Bobi Wine is."
An X-ray shows Abola now has damaged vertebrae in her lower back and needs immediate surgery. Unfortunately for Abola, she does not have the $5,000 required to pay for the operation. Asara Knight says soldiers cornered her in the same hotel that evening and began beating her.
When they mentioned my name and all these opposition women, it was like, for those soldiers, today is our day. It reached a point I could not now realize the pain on my body. Because it was too much, I could not now shout, I could not talk, they were just beating. Now when they realized I was not shouting, the only thing, they just had to carry me like a sack from the hotel. They threw me through the window outside. That's where I was carried to be thrown in the vehicle of the police.
Asara now wears braces on her back, hand and knee and has constant headaches. The alleged beatings took place after an incident in which protesters threw stones at the convoy of President Yoweri Museveni, who was in the area campaigning for the ruling party candidate. Museveni has come under increasing criticism both at home and abroad for his government's heavy-handed response to any dissent. Bobi Wine, the president's most prominent critic, was arrested last month and charged with treason before leaving for the United States to receive medical treatment. Jane Abola and Asara Knight maintain that their group did not cross paths with the president's on August 13th because Wandri's rally that night was in a different location, in Arua. Both remain in Kampala hospitals recovering from their injuries. No Ugandan official has specifically denied the women's allegations. Last week, however, President Museveni said that anyone who alleged torture by security personnel would need to prove it in court. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
The United Nations says it is scaling up its assistance in Zimbabwe after the government made an international appeal for about $60 million to deal with a cholera outbreak which has so far claimed close to 36 people and has now spread to several parts of the country since its inception about 3 weeks ago. Columbus Mavonga has more from Harare.
In an interview, Sirak Gebrahote, the United Nations spokesman in Zimbabwe, said his organization is now considering activating the UN Emergency Response Fund as the cholera outbreak has now claimed at least 30 people in less than 3 weeks and has since spread to most parts of the country.
In light of the appeal announced by the government of Zimbabwe in response to the cholera outbreak, the UN has scaled up its support. The regional office of the UN, Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, has already deployed 3 emergency and humanitarian specialists in the ongoing response. This is in addition to our colleagues from UNICEF and WHO who have been already engaged on the ground in this emergency response.
On Tuesday, the Zimbabwean government said the almost $60 million it is seeking from the international world would be used to ensure that there's an improvement of clean water supply and sanitation, as well as a regular trash collection from the hotspots of cholera, factors which experts say are behind the current outbreak. President Emmerson Mnangagwa, in his State of the Nation address on Tuesday, said this about this waterborne disease, cholera.
My government is indeed heavily perturbed by the current outbreak of waterborne diseases, such as cholera and typhoid. It is regrettable that this has resulted in the wanton loss of life. Let us, as a nation, commit to permanently eradicate these medieval diseases, mainly through addressing the challenges related to clean water and sanitation provision, sustainable waste management practices.
But Hilda Betha Rwambiwa, the head of the Community Water Alliance, a local NGO, which for years has been calling for an improved water supply and sanitation, says the Zimbabwean government has failed and is behind the current ravaging waterborne disease outbreak.
It will deal with only the symptoms and not the real root cause of the problem. Harare alone, it requires an investment of close to about 500 million to revamp both the sewer treatment plant and the water distribution pipes, as well as the sewer reticulation system.
Zimbabwe is battling to contain another ravaging cholera outbreak. In 2008-2009, the pandemic killed nearly 5,000 people. It only stopped after international organizations chipped in with medical drugs and water treatment chemicals. Columbus Mavunga for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
While flu outbreaks, Ebola and HIV typically generate the biggest headlines, scientists say tuberculosis remains the number one infectious disease killer globally, affecting about one quarter of the world's population. The UN General Assembly hopes to draw more attention to the problem by hosting its first ever high-level meeting on tuberculosis. VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Life has not been easy for 54-year-old Stella Malhaus. The South African woman takes 9 pills a day, down from the 27 she used to take each day. But she's HIV positive, unemployed, and suffers from MDR-TB, multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. She says the stigma of disease makes her life all the more difficult.
I got my family. They can share a plate with me, offer mark with me. I have to have my own. And then people, they won't want to come close to you because they are afraid that if you are going to talk to Neo, that's like the wind are going to blow it in his way, that people are also going to get it.
Tuberculosis may not garner the kind of attention of other diseases, such as HIV, malaria, or the highly publicized Ebola. But Hank Tomlinson of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says TB should not be ignored.
It's the number one infectious disease killer. It kills more people now annually than HIV. There are about 1.7 million deaths each year from tuberculosis, and it's a threat everywhere because of the way it's spread and the ease with which it is spread.
TB is such a threat. The UN General Assembly is holding its first ever high-level meeting on the infectious disease to urge countries to pool resources together and address the epidemic. According to the CDC, about 2 billion people are infected with tuberculosis worldwide. The CDC's Rebecca Martin says preventative treatment is crucial, especially for those with the latent form of the disease.
Getting them on treatment, which is less expensive, a shorter course, and the adherence is much higher, we can stop going on to active TB, which leads to spread of more TB.
Jill Craig, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. Former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says she's disappointed by claims that her government printed about 16 billion Liberian dollars, or about 104 million U.S. dollars, and brought it into the country, unknown to the George Weah government. The former president told Liberia's front page Africa newspaper that Information Minister Eugene Nambwe and Justice Minister Frank Musa Dean are trying to impugn her legacy. That's it for this Wednesday, September 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington saying have a good day.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.